Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. It's our monthly book show. The theme this month is restaurants. With us, reference librarian Jill Erickson. Hi, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Falmouth Enterprise food columnist Gail Blakely. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Mindy.
All right, so this was your idea. I was like, restaurant, but this all comes from the show The Bear, which I have not seen, but I've heard a lot about it.
It really did come out of this TV show.
You're watching The Bear, you go,
but
hey!
I'm watching The Bear. Well, you know, as many people did, you watch it and you learn so much about how restaurants run, right? You really, and there's, needless to say, it's a television show. There's lots and lots of drama. And so I thought, well, how about doing a show just on restaurants, books about restaurants? There, you know, there must be hundreds of them. There weren't as many as I thought there would be, but I did find a great collection of restaurant books, and I think you will enjoy the show very much.
All right, so what are you going to start with? Fun.
Well, as I often do, I don't do this on purpose. It sort of just happens. I found a poem or two.
Of course you did.
That have to do with restaurants. Now, who would think that people were writing poems by restaurants, but these are both. I have two. Don't worry, Mindy, they're not too long.
No. I know one of them is Billy Collins.
One
and I
is
love Billy
Collins, and the other one is Ogden Nash. For those of you that recall who Ogden Nash is, he at one time he was started in the 1940s publishing books, but we'll start with the Billy Collins,
okay.
From his book Ballistics. And the title of this poem is Old Man Eating Alone in a Chinese Restaurant. I am glad I resisted the temptation, if it was a temptation when I was young, to write a poem about an old man eating alone at a corner table in a Chinese restaurant. I would have gotten it all wrong, thinking, the poor bastard, not a friend in the world, and with only a book for a companion, he'll probably pay the bill out of a change purse. So glad I waited all these decades to record how hot and sour the hot and sour soup is here at Chang's this afternoon, and how cold the Chinese beer in a frosted glass. And my book, Jose Saramago's Blindness, as it turns out, is so absorbing that I look up from its escalating horrors only when I am stunned by one of his arresting sentences. And I should mention the light, which falls through the big windows this time of day, italicizing everything it touches, the plates and teapots, the immaculate tablecloths, as well as the soft brown hair of the waitress in the white blouse and short black skirt, the one who is smiling now as she bears a cup of rice and shredded beef with garlic to my favorite table in the corner.
<That's>
I
wonderful.
Just think it's a lovely poem. That's
really
Billy Collins,
wonderful.
Old man eating alone in a Chinese restaurant. And going a different direction completely, those of you that know Ogden Nash, he's a very funny guy. I mean, know his work. Mm-hmm. He's long gone.
Yeah, right.
And this caught my eye. I had no idea he had ever written a poem about a restaurant. The book is The Private Dining Room and Other Verses, which is what caught my eye when I was just looking around at books. And this poem is called The Chef Has Imagination, or It's Too Hard to Do It Easy. Hark to a lettuce lover, I consider lettuce a blessing. And what do I want on my lettuce? Simply a simple dressing. But in dining car and hostel, I glow apoplectic and dropsical. Is this dressing upon my lettuce, or is it a melting popsicle? Dressing is not the meal, dears. It requires nor cream nor egg, not butter nor maple sugar, and neither the nut nor the meg. A dressing is not a compote. A dressing is not a custard. It consists of pepper and salt, vinegar, oil, and mustard. It is not paprika and pickles. Let us leave those to the Teutons. It is not a pinkish puddle of grenadine and fig Newtons. Must I journey to France for dressing? It isn't a baffling problem. Just omit the molasses and yogurt, the wheat germ and the pabulum. It's oil and vinegar, dears. No need to tittle and toil. Just salt and pepper and mustard and vinegar and oil. For brilliant savarin, then, and hoil, stick friends to vinegar and oil. Yachtsman, jettison, boom, and spinnaker, bring me oil and bring me vinegar. Play the music of Haydn or Honegger, but lace it with honest oil and vinegar. Choir in church or mosque or synagogue, sing, please, in praise of oil and vinegar. I'm not an expert, just a beginner, but I place my trust in oil and vinegar. May they perish as Remus was perished by Romulus, who monkey with this, the most sacred of formulas. That's, so that is.
Goodness. But you know what? You wonder what's going through his head that he wrote this poem about oil and vinegar, right?
Well, right. And clearly he had had a real experience. It sounds like it was a real experience, right?
Yeah.
And he just, that's all he wanted. Oil and vinegar?
Well, how did he find all these words and make them up as well that rhyme with vinegar? That's really hard.
That's a real challenge, I would say.
And I love the line, the nut, not the meg.
Yeah.
I couldn't remember that. That's a terrific line.
Anyway, this was in The Private Dining Room and Other Verses by Ogden Nash.
All right. Gail, what have you got?
Oh, my goodness. I have a couple of books that I think are probably classics. I really wanted to focus on some female chefs because there haven't been a lot of them. And, of course, the first one that I like that really reflects California totally is Judy Rogers' Zuni Cafe.
Mm.
Which is a lovely illustrated book and also just talks about, you know, these books give philosophy, the philosophy of the chefs, like the oil and vinegar philosophy. I think this one is most well known for her chicken, roast chicken over bitter greens and served over a salad of bitter greens. So all the chicken juices go down in. And, of course, the cubed bread that roasts with the chicken gets tossed with all the chicken juices and all of
that. I love a cookbook that has pictures because that, I flip through and I go, ooh, I want to make that.
Yeah.
And those are pretty,
This is, it weighs a ton, which cut down on the number of books I could bring. it's
Yeah, people
really
don't realize we put the books on the table. So, you got to carry all
of those. That's true. So Judy Rogers, definitely. And she's no longer with us, unfortunately.
And what's the name of the book?
The name of the book is The Zuni Cafe Cookbook.
Zuni Cafe.
A compendium of recipes and cooking lessons from San Francisco's beloved restaurant, Zuni Cafe. I believe she spent some time with Alice Waters as well.
Okay.
And, of course, a James Beard Foundation winner, IACP Cookbook Awards, just lots of good stuff.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. All right. What have you got next, Jill?
Well, you mentioned Alice Waters.
Uh-huh. Of course.
And I brought, I found this book. I didn't know it existed. And I certainly had heard of Alice Waters and her books.
Is this Fanny's?
But this is Fanny at Chez Panisse. Have you seen this book?
I have seen that. That's lovely.
It is so delightful. Mm-hmm. It's a child's restaurant adventures with 46 recipes. It's Fanny at Chez Panisse by Alice Waters. And it is so much fun for kids, but also I found it really enjoyable as well, reading what this kid, because she grew up with the restaurant. Now, Alice Waters is writing in her daughter's voice, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it is beautifully illustrated. And it then comes on, it talks about all her adventures in the kitchen with her mother. And it also, for example, these are my mom's special rules. My mom is always saying these are the most important things she knows about food. So I wrote them down for her. Go to the market or garden before you decide what to cook. Mm-hmm. Taste, smell, touch, listen, and look carefully. All your senses tell you things about food, how to pick it, how to cook it, and how to eat it. Look for fruits and vegetables in season. Those are always the ones that taste the best and cost the least. Always look for food that's organically grown. It is the healthiest for you, and organic farmers take care of the earth for all of us. Most of all, my mom says, if you want to make people happy, cook them something good to eat. those are her rules. But it also just sort of tells the story from the daughter's point of view, what it was like to be growing up in a restaurant, which is what she did. And it also has a whole section of recipes at the back that I supposedly any child can work on. I'm not sure that's true. I think they might need a little supervision. However, they're not very fancy recipes, but there are things in here like calzone, pizza dough, white and whole wheat bread. I mean, some substantial things that you as an adult might want to eat, or your child. They might be good things that your child would really enjoy them. But the stories are really fun, and it is just a really interesting point of view from the kid who has grown up in a kitchen called Fanny at Chez Panisse.
Love it. All right. Gail.
I really love that book. I think that is just wonderful. I'm so looking to reach the next generation as they come along. My grandniece has become enamored of cooking. She can't decide whether she wants to be a hockey player or a or a chef. But anyway. You know, one book I want to mention that I expected you to have is Kitchen Confidential. Did you bring?
I didn't because I mentioned him previously, but it's a really good book to talk about.
And certainly is, you know, is I think probably one of the major books that exposed us to what a restaurant is really like. Anthony Bourdain just did a fabulous job, and that started his career, right? And,
right, absolutely. It's a really good read.
It's unfortunately it's so true.
Yeah.
So very true. Yeah. This is Blood, Bones, and Butter by Gabrielle Hamilton, who owns Prune in New York. And I'm just looking. Anthony Bourdain said, "This is magnificent, simply the best memoir by a chef ever, ever," he says. "She packs more heart, soul, and pure power into one beautifully crafted page than I've accomplished in my entire writing career." He noticed he doesn't say television career because that would have been allowed. But this is a woman's view of coming up in the industry. I think Judy Rogers' book is more recipe focused, and this one is a lot more about Blood, Bones, and Butter. Yeah. Says it all, doesn't
it? I love
the title. Yeah. It's really a lovely, lovely title. And other chefs have praised her as well. So I think this is a really fun one.
Yeah, Blood, Bones, and Butter.
Yep. All right. Gabrielle Hamilton.
Yeah, and we're going to have a list up on our website later today of all of the books we talk about. People, they try to jot it down real fast. And don't worry, we'll have it all out there for you a little later at our website, capeandislands.org. We are talking about books with a restaurant theme this morning. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to suggest one for our book list. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a quick break.
You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show. The theme this month is restaurants. With us is reference librarian Jill Erickson and Falmouth Enterprise food columnist Gail Blakely. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Dan has made a suggestion. He suggests Restaurant at the End of the Universe by Douglas Adams. But I don't know that book.
I don't either.
Yeah. Dan, you want to tell us anything about the book? Dan's got to jump on the microphone there. I guess it's part of the
It's part of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy saga. Right. And it's just a conglomeration of characters, events, fantasy, crazy science fiction. And it's worth a read if you're a Hitchhiker's fan.
So like an escape. You want to escape the reality?
Oh, this is beyond escape.
All right. Yes. We'll add that to the list. Thank you, Dan. We'd love to hear from you if you have a suggestion for us as well. Jill, what's next?
Well, I couldn't be sitting on Cape Cod without bringing this book, which is Historic Restaurants of Cape Cod by Christopher Sederlund. It is a fascinating book. Not to mention, the first chapter I was engaged with is the one on the Dome Restaurant.
I couldn't be sitting
a stone's throw away from the Dome Restaurant without mentioning the Dome Restaurant.
Did you ever eat there?
I did.
Long time ago.
28 years or so ago I ate there. But as it, here's a little bit from the chapter on the Dome Restaurant, and it says it was active from 1954 to 2002. I wasn't sure it even made it to 2002, but 2002. Buildings come in all shapes and sizes. There are countless uniquely designed structures all over Cape Cod. Simply taking a drive down Route 6A can open up a world of wonder and amazement at some of the newer and historic homes that don't fit the normal mold. The same can be said for restaurants. Not all are built the same. In fact, in Orleans, the Hunan Gourmet 3 Chinese restaurant is actually built into the side of a hill.
Huh.
However, any uniquely designed restaurant on Cape Cod, current or past, must take a back seat to the Dome Restaurant, which resided in the small scientific community at Woods Hole. This one-of-a-kind establishment existed inside an actual geodesic dome. A geodesic dome is sphere-like in shape and consists of a thin skin with a network of triangles as a frame, evenly distributing stress on the dome. And it was the brainchild of R. Buckminster Fuller. Anybody in Falmouth probably knows this. But there are other things in here as well.
We had the CAI opening party at the Dome.
Is that?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a piece of history.
There you go. That's a good
you
trivia
guys have
question.
Been around longer than I recall. It seems just like yesterday when Allison came to the library desk and said, hey, we're going to put out a radio show. Great.
Yeah.
Anyway, Elsie's is another Falmouth.
Oh, yeah.
And when I was a child and my parents, or more like a teen or later years, my parents always used to come to Falmouth because they loved Elsie's. Mm. And so I remember Elsie's, which is at was at 553 Palmer Avenue and is now a different, a good restaurant, but a different restaurant. Mm. Elsie's finally closed. And Elsie's had started in Cambridge, and I knew the Elsie's in Cambridge as well. So that they have a great section on that. They also have a section on recipes from some of these.
And Jenny says, Elsie's cranberry shake. We're bringing back memories to everybody this morning.
It's going to happen. Here's the restaurant for cheese spread, the Dome Restaurant. 2 pounds Cooper cheese, 2 pounds Neufchâtel.
That's Neufchâtel.
I'm so glad you're here. Half a teaspoon granulated garlic, a half a teaspoon salt, 1 dash of tobacco, and
Tabasco.
Food coloring.
Yeah. Like, and the food
why do you put yellow food coloring into your dressing? Because it looks better?
Yep.
That would be the reason.
Because you eat with your eyes first, they say.
Yeah. Right. Anyway, there are recipes in here. There are all kinds of stories. My Tin Man Diner that was at North Falmouth this year. And I will say there are lots of other restaurants in other towns. We just happen to be sitting in Falmouth at the moment. A lot of Hyannis restaurants, West Yarmouth restaurants that were once here and are no longer. So the historic restaurants of Cape Cod, and along with this I have, which I also knew nothing, I mean, I knew a lot about this restaurant, but I didn't know it started in Massachusetts, which is a history of Howard Johnson's, how a Massachusetts soda fountain became an American icon by Anthony Mitchell Sammarco. And it's such a fun book to read. If you knew nothing, if all you knew about was the fried clams and the ice cream, which is pretty much what I knew as a child.
Ice cream, yeah.
Was the 26 flavors, was it? And so here's a little bit. They were doing an interview. The Globe was doing an interview with the author. And the question was, once you open the floodgates by gathering people's stories, what kind of things did they want to share? And he responds, I go on WBZ, and once I talked about Howard Johnson, and people would call in and tell me stories about how their grandfather was his butler. Now, here was a man with an eighth grade education, but he had done so well that he had a mansion in Milton. So they told me the stories about how grand a life he had actually led. Other people would call and say, my granddad was a candy dipper in a candy factor. These candies were sold on the counter at the restaurants so you could take them home after dinner. The Saffron family says, quote, my family provided clams for Howard Johnson's for 32 years.
Wow.
32 years. And then they'll follow it up with photographs of Greek women in Ipswich shucking clams, and also the fact that they created the first clam strip to be served to the American public by Howard Johnson's. People come out with all these stories, and sometimes I sit there and think, how do I substantiate it? A lot of times it's been a good generation since Howard Johnson's have been around, but people have these great stories to tell me. How do you distill it so it appeals to the entire public? And the book itself is a really fascinating, I found it to be a very fascinating read. Again, knowing not much about what happened, and they have some recipes in here for the clam chowder, the grilled Frankfurt, which was my favorite thing.
Hard to do, though, that grilled Frankfurt.
It was butter. Lots of butter seemed to have been involved, as far as I can tell. Yeah. And Orleans, there's a whole chapter on Orleans and the beginning of the orange-roofed empire, because apparently the restaurant in Orleans was the first one that was built after the original.
Oh,
so there's a whole chapter on what it was like to, how it happened that one of the second ones that was built was built in Orleans. And I'm sure there are plenty of people that who
I knew there was one at the
that.
Bridge. Yeah.
Yeah, right. That's right. There was.
I'm always surprised in my 40 years of writing my food column how many local chefs, just home cooks, really have something to say about Howard Johnson's. Mm. Either they did recipe testing and development for the organization, or they just have these wonderful memories of going back.
Well, they were
and,
everywhere, right?
Fried, and grilled Frankfurts and that kind of wonderful retro stuff. How can it be bad, right? But it's really an important part of our food culture here.
Anyway, this is there are all kinds of fabulous stories about various Howard Johnsons in this book, and it's just a really fun read. A history of, especially if you ever were in Howard Johnson's, a history of Howard Johnson's, how a Massachusetts soda fountain became an American icon, Anthony Mitchell Sammarco.
Yeah, it just reminded me of Friendly's. Remember Friendly's was the other, and now I think I read the last Friendly's restaurant closed.
No, there's still some more in Massachusetts, but the last one in Boston closed.
Oh,
it was at
Boston.
Logan Airport. Yeah.
Well, and that it's still, that building is sitting empty. It's like puts a knife through you every time you
that
go
was my,
by.
That was my first job, you know, as you know, working on tobacco. I lived in Connecticut. That was my first job. That was the only job you could get at 14 besides babysitting. But once I turned 16, my first job was Friendly's. And I will tell you, I didn't eat ice cream for years after that because you know, too much. And you know, you're sticky up to the shoulder. Yeah, but I kind of liked Friendly's. Yeah. What have you got next, Gail?
I have Gordon Hammersley, who again is looking back into the past. He spent some time on television with Julia Child and some of her programs. But I remember 2003 is when this cookbook came out, another big one, another beautifully.
Oh, yeah. Look at those pictures.
Beautifully illustrated with his photos. And this was really, excuse me. I think this was his, our introduction to bistro cooking, French bistro cooking. Certainly Alice Waters began some of it with using the fresh produce and the freshest of fresh ingredients. But he became known for his, another chicken recipe. I should raise chickens. Chicken just simmered with tarragon and some wonderful, wonderful herbs, giving it a very different flavor. And this is one. What I like about the Howard Johnson's book is that you can go back and cook and say, well, it's not really Howard Johnson's, but it tastes like it used to be. And with Gordon Hammersley, who is no longer running his restaurant, I believe he's retired in Boston, you can cook from his, make some of Gordon Hammersley iconic dishes, and he was a fabulous, fabulous cook.
Bistro cooking at home.
Okay. Sarah's giving us a call from Dartmouth. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Oh, great. I'm just calling to say that I highly recommend Kwame Onwuachi's 2019 book, Notes from a Young Black Chef. that describes his adventures in the restaurant world. Mm. He's currently the chef at Tatiana, the New York Times number one restaurant in New York City. Mm. And it's a really fascinating read. I used to teach a history class on the history of American food and agriculture, and the students loved reading this book.
Oh, great. Notes from a Young Black Chef. Love it. Thank you, Sarah. Thanks for that.
Appreciate sort of like that. Yes, Chef by Marcus Samuelson, mm-hmm. who wrote his memoir of being a black man and bringing all of his culture and identity to his cooking.
Yeah. Sarah, thanks for the call. If you have a suggestion for us for the list, 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill.
Well, the next book I have was recommended to me by a friend of mine who I have to at least give him a small plug because he suggested this book. Jeff Wisner is actually also the editor of a book that's about to come out called A Year of Birds, Writing on Birds from the Journal of Henry David Thoreau. He also was the editor of Thoreau's Wildflowers, Thoreau's Animals, and he said, you should read, if you're doing this topic, Stanley Park, a novel by Timothy Taylor, a Canadian author who I'd never heard of before, and decided that, yes, I should, you know, take a look at it. And it is, I am convinced that somebody that had been working on The Bear read this book and decided this would make
this
a great show.
Yeah.
Because the chef in this book is a young guy. He is full of himself. He gets into all kinds of trouble. And I'm reading it and I'm like, and they describe the part. Now, there are two different parts of this book. The part I found most fascinating was the kitchen part. And the, here, let me just read a little bit of this. It's really and he's also got a father, I should say, who is living in the woods and like eating squirrels and things. Mm. And the two worlds sort of collide at one point. But here's a little bit about how much the novel talks about what it is to be a chef. One of the American students came up with these names at the Culinary Institute in Dijon, and they stuck. Crips versus Bloods. Crip cooks were critical. They fused, they strove for innovation, they were post-national. They called themselves artists. They tended to sack things like mahi-mahi and grilled eggplant in wobbly towers glued together with wasabi mayonnaise and were frequently suspicious of butter. Vegetarianism was an option for Crips, but not for Bloods. Blood cooks were respectful of tradition, nostalgic even, canonical, interested in the veracity of things culinary, linked to local by the inheritance or adoption of a culture, linked to a particular manner and place of being. Blood cooks like sweetbreads and po'o few. Bloods ate tacos, bratwurst, borscht. They used lard and as much foie gras as they could get their hands on. So you learn a lot about the chefs themselves. And it is really, and then the main character who talks a lot about, who talks a lot like the character in The Bear, and this is one of his quotes. Jeremy, who's the chef, considered this confession. The intent is spontaneity, Jules went on. But the more I think about it, the more I imagine our creations to be the product of a spontaneity rule of some kind, like classic ingredient A plus exotic technique B plus totally unexpected strange ingredient C equals wacky dish D. Sauce with something black or dark blue and you're good to go. Jeremy was nodding. Everything works clearly, she continued. Creme de Bourbon and lemongrass tart is actually very good, but I sometimes think what I'm doing is totally incoherent, that I'd rather make key lime pie. it's a really fascinating read, and I do think, I mean, the parts that are about the restaurant itself are really fascinating. The part about the father in the woods eating the squirrels. Mm. Not quite. So, but the two of them come together. There's actually a murder that's involved with this, but the murder is not really the prime heir of decision. And one other little bit from him, Jeremy, the cook is talking, the chef opening nights are special. After opening night, you become a normal restaurant again. You open, you close, you buy, prep, and cook, you clean up and restock, go out and have a drink, sleep too little, do it again. But on opening night, you put on a play about yourself, like theater, like a culinary monologue. You stand out there in front of a new house and you say, "This is my kitchen. This is who I am. This is how we have become who we are." So it is called
That's
Stanley
really nice.
Park by Timothy Taylor.
Wow. Right.
Talk to you.
And isn't Jeremy also the name of the chef in the bear?
That is true.
Oh, that is true.
I hadn't even thought of that. I'm telling you. Yeah. Somebody read this book.
All right. Linda's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hello.
Yep, go ahead.
Well, I'm just a few minutes past your segment on Howard Johnson's, but I was just going to say, I worked at the Howard Johnson's in Falmouth in 1969.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, boy.
What was your favorite to eat?
Everybody came on Wednesday night for spaghetti night and on Friday night for fried clams.
Okay.
So we brought back
some areas. It's a family restaurant, and so everybody brought, you know, a million kids, and they wanted seven Cokes. And
Oh, Linda, thanks for that. Thanks for calling. Rick is calling from Chatham. Hi, Rick. Rick, are you there? All right. Well, we'll come. We have Rick?
All right. Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, okay. We got you. All right. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Mindy. Rick Morris of the Chatham Filling. And I'm sorry I missed the first half of the show. I'm sure you touched on a few of the familiar books that us in the restaurant industry have, you know, you guys are talking about The Bear, and I'm sure we've talked about Anthony Bourdain and all that. I wanted to talk about a guy named Paul Friedman, who's more of a restaurant historian. And he writes about American cuisine, 10 restaurants that changed America. He goes through the whole history of all the way back to Delmonico's up to Chez Panisse, and really, really how the culture's changed, how Howard Johnson's kind of changed the way people ate on the road, and then that kind of morphed into the fast foods and kind of killed the American diner. Although the American diner's coming back now. That's what we are in the business doing, diner food.
Yeah, comfort food, right? Diner food's comfort food, yeah.
And I have to say, Rick, that I have that book sitting in front of me. It is an incredible book, that 10 Restaurants That Changed America. And the chapter on Schraff's was really fascinating, which was all about seeking out the female customer. It's a really interesting group of books. And Chez Panisse is in here, and Delmonico's, and the Four. But to go from Howard Johnson's to the Four Seasons, it's a really fascinating read.
I
have his book American Cuisine, which is trying to crack that mystery of what is American cuisine, and all from the different cultures, from the indigenous peoples to the enslaved Africans, to the Europeans, to the Caribbean influence, and things like that. So that's what we kind of try to do with our restaurant. Even though we're more just a breakfast place, we try to make it fun, and we try to incorporate the, you know, what's been organically developed as American food. I also worked at a restaurant called American Seasons in on Nantucket, which they had, you know, this is back in the late 90s. And it's, the place is still running strong, but they have four different menus, and they're the Wild West, Deep South, Pacific Coast, and then New England. So you can order all over the place. You know.
Well, Rick, thanks for the suggestions. We appreciate that. Thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a break.
You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show. We're talking about books about restaurants this morning with reference librarian Jill Erickson and Falmouth Enterprise food columnist Gail Blakely. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to make a suggestion. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, we have Creighton Wright's restaurant cookbook. So many. Black Axe, Mangle, House of Small Wonders, a very serious cookbook, Superiority Burger Cookbook, vegetarian, Provincetown Seafood, Ukrainian Cuisine in 70 Dishes. Thanks for those suggestions. And Daniel writes, Tomato Rhapsody, a fable of love, lust, and forbidden fruit. 17th century fable about how tomatoes came to Italy, includes market scenes, kitchen scenes, crazy characters, and it's hilarious. Thanks for those suggestions.
Those all sound great.
That one sounds like kind of fun, right?
Will those go up on the website, too?
Oh, yeah. We'll have all these. All right. What have you got next, Jill?
Well, I have another novel here. It's called Crescent by Diana Abu-Jabir. And this was her second novel. And I'm almost positive I read this when it first came out, which was quite some time ago. But it is a really interesting premise. And I have to say, one of the things that really caught my eye was Cape Cod is mentioned on page 31. Ooh. So, you know, anything where they, but very briefly it's mentioned, and I will read it just because I'm sitting on Cape Cod. But Aziz seems to enjoy the discussion about himself. She can't tell if he's overheard Nathan or not. Yes, my little book and I do get around, he says. We were escorted out of Damascus abruptly, and for a while we were teaching somewhere on Cape Cod. No one ever told me the name of the town. So that's the Cape Cod mention. But it is about a 39-year-old Iraqi-American chef who mixes mouthwatering dishes at Nadia's Cafe in Los Angeles. Yet she's stirring up more than just meals. She's feeding a nostalgic hunger among the immigrants in this Middle Eastern community just off the UCLA campus. She's also releasing a steady stream of her own repressed memories of her parents, who died suddenly when she was 9, and of her mother's cooking and of the elaborate stories of the uncle who raised her. But the general loneliness of the students who crowd the cafe is nothing compared to the soulful ache of Hanif al-Ayad, a handsome and mysterious new professor in the Department of Near Eastern Studies. The fact of exile is bigger than everything else in my life, explains Hanif, who fled Iraq after agitating against Saddam Hussein's early rule. As Serene and Hanif are drawn together, Hanif reclaims a measure of his rootedness, and even if their passion can seem overcooked, the special flavors of longing and estrangement infuse this book with vital insight. And this was the review from the New York Times Book Review. And it really, I think I read it years ago when it came out, but I feel like I need to pick it up and read it again. It seems so contemporary, even though it was written so long ago. And I think that it would be a fun book, but also a heartbreaking book. Yeah. Crescent by Diana Abu-Jabir.
All right.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Gail, what's next?
I have one on staff meals, which is sort of the heart of your restaurant, because very often staff comes in, they do all their prep, and then just before service starts, they sit down to a staff meal or family meal, as it sometimes is called. And this is by the owner of Chanterelle, David Waltuck, and he goes through New York City's restaurants. 200 recipes share the delectable elbows on the table dishes enjoyed every day during home style staff meals. It's lovely, although it's a little pedantic at times, but it still is really worth looking at. I find that because this takes place in a restaurant, the ingredients very often for some of these recipes are ones that would be difficult for home cooks to get a hold of. Although it says, at Chanterelle, customers of New York's sophisticated and acclaimed restaurant dine on foie gras and truffles. The staff eats smothered pork chops. The staff, elbows on the table, cheerfully tucks into Singapore-style curried rice noodles and just the homey stuff, almost the Howard Johnson kind of recipes. And I'm finding now, as I get to know some of our local chefs, thinking of Ricky Smith at Kunameset, he's the executive chef there, and he learns so much from his staff, who are primarily from the islands, and he has incorporated a lot of their cooking from eating their staff meals that they prepare for him, jerk chicken all summer. He said it's fabulous. He's incorporating that into his actual menu. So I think, you know, things are really coming full cycle, aren't they?
Yes.
And I do recommend this one because it's really a great idea for a cookbook. And
staff meals, I love that. Not all restaurants obviously do that, but maybe they
should. Most do. Yeah. Certainly fine dining does.
Fine dining, yeah. Okay.
The Bear, they had...
Back to the Bear.
That's what I know about staff meals.
Okay. What do we got next, Jill?
Well, I brought this along. I have yet to finish it. And I see there's this whole argument about which is the best translation of this book. So now I've ordered another translation. It's called The Belly of Paris by Emile Zola. Mm-hmm. If any of you have, I feel like when I was... I don't know, a teenager, I was reading Emile Zola. I don't know why. Somebody must have told me, read Emile Zola. But this is, it's a really intense read. I got not that far into it, and there were so many very vivid descriptions of killing various things. I sort of had to stop for a while. In the intro to this, and this, interestingly, was translated by Mark Kurlansky. It's a new translation, and many of you probably know Mark Kurlansky from his other books, The Cod, and so forth and so on. But he writes in his intro, "Today, in an age when gastronomic fiction has become fashionable, this book seems ahead of its time. But despite Zola's being a bourgeois who loved food and looked it, the social criticism in The Belly of Paris revolves around the graphically illustrated conceit that the bourgeoisie not only eats too much, but has an unhealthy obsession with food." And there are some beautiful descriptions of what's going on there, and but also there are a lot of skewered animals. So here's a little bit from the novel itself. "It was no doubt there that Quenu found his love of cooking. Later on, after trying out every other trade, he returned as though it were his destiny to the skewered animals whose juice made you lick your fingers. At first, he was worried about irritating his brother, a man of little appetite who spoke of tasty things with the disdain of a man who has not tasted. But then, watching Florent listen to him as Quenu explained some very complicated dish, he declared it to be his true vocation and started working for a large restaurant. From that time on, a new pattern was established for the two brothers. They continued to live in the room on Rue Royer Collard, where they returned every evening, the one with the face lit by the heat of the ovens, the other with the beaten face of a mud-spattered teacher. Florent kept his old black coat, losing himself in his student's homework, while Quenu, to make himself comfortable, tied on his apron, put on his white coat and white chef's hat, and stood over the stove, rattling the skillet and entertaining himself by cooking some delicacy." Mm. Now, there's a lot of politics that goes into this story as well, which is sort of interesting in and of itself. And it's also interesting that one of the New Criterion wrote an article about this particular translation, and people are, and apparently there'd been another translation, which now I have to look at because just because I want. And they say his translation of Zola's great novel is serviceable enough, excellent in spots, and lazy and careless in others. He appears to have been selected for the job on the rather bizarre assumption that The Belly of Paris fits in with the modern fashion for gastronomic literature and will appeal to foodies, who, of course, are legion among today's book buyers. Mm. So you can try either translation, and it's called The Belly of Paris. There's a lot of killing of animals in this book.
So be prepared.
Be prepared if you don't wish to read that.
Any book that has belly in the title, don't you think is going to be, I think that's sort of a hint.
It's like a warning, All right, what have you got next, Gail?
I'm going to take a little break from actual books with recipes, although this one does have them. This is probably my very most favorite book that got me going in 1983, Nora Ephron and her wonderful Romana Clef, Heartburn, which is a delightful read.
And even made a good film out of it.
And made a great film, and also has really, really good recipes. I was going through a breakup of a relationship at the time that this came out, so Rachel Samstedt, the heroine, is getting a divorce, and she is a food writer and a cook, and she goes around and does demonstrations and writes up recipes and, you know, does what food writers do. Here's what she says about her one of the best recipes in here for pot roast. Normally, I enjoy doing food demonstrations. I like giving my speech. I like the way it laces in and out of the subject of food. But when I was about halfway through the demonstration at Macy's, I was right in the middle of cooking Lillian Hellman's pot roast. I realized I was in trouble. Lillian Hellman's pot roast is the sort of recipe that makes my reputation in the food world what it is, since it contains all sorts of low-rent ingredients like a package of onion soup mix and a can of cream of mushroom soup. It even has something called kitchen bouquet that I always leave out. She goes on to just list the recipe, the ingredients, and I have to say that whenever I make this, people do love it. I know it is low rent, but that it's does, really
low rent's
really
okay
cool.
Sometimes. Oh, yeah,
definitely. Yeah. People would probably say Howard Johnson's was low rent. But I think this is just, you can see how well worn this is, and I really highly recommend this. Read, reread.
Yeah.
It's just
Heartburn
one of those.
By Nora Ephron.
Heartburn by Nora Ephron.
All right, Jill.
Okay, so I have another book which is recent, called The Next Supper, The End of Restaurants as We Knew Them and What Comes After by Corey Mintz. And there was a review of this, which was very interesting, in something called the Manhattan Book Review, which I had never seen before. And so I've learned something new about another web that I didn't know about. And he writes, and they write in this book, former cook and restaurant critic Corey Mintz wants to find a better way for eating out without supporting horrific business practices common to the dining industry. COVID-19, of course, devastated the industry, and supermarkets rushed in to fill part of the void as meal providers. This further crippled struggling restaurants, as did food delivery services. The latter often reduced meager profits for restaurants rather than increasing them. Mintz exhaustively covers the problems and issues that plague restaurants. In this respect, he continues the work begun by the late Anthony Bourdain. As he well illustrates, these problems can be made worse by customers who are not always right. Mm. Fortunately, this is not one of those nonfiction books intended to create massive feelings of guilt and powerlessness in its readers. Mintz optimistically believes that there's a better future for restaurants and seeks to enlist every one of us making that future a reality. That review was by Joseph Arellano, and the book is The Next Supper by Corey Mintz.
Mm. You know, I was just thinking of Anthony Bourdain and how he didn't like the Yelp reviews, right? Mm. Because, and you know, it's true. People go in and they have a good, but sometimes people don't understand how a restaurant works, and they don't say, hey, this isn't cooked the way I like it, or, you know, they should talk to the restaurant. Maybe they're going to make it good. You know, everybody has a bad day. But yeah, sometimes the reviews, like, read some of these books and you'll understand what goes on in
what
a restaurant.
What they have to get through, yes.
I know. I know you've gone through all your books, Gail, but you should mention High on the Hog.
Okay.
Yeah.
High on the Hog is a television show streaming, and I think you can get it on most streaming apps or devices or whatever they are. And it is the story, the first season is 4 episodes, and it's the story of the African diaspora coming over here and enslaved people, and how they influenced our cuisine across the country. It's not just Southern cuisine. It is cowboys, the story of cowboys who were actually people who rode horses and roped in the cows, and that's how the name came. This second series, second year, this year is just as good. Yeah. And it's really, I think,
highly recommended.
Every American should read it, and I think it should be shown in schools. Right. I feel
so
that strongly about it.
And then we have the
a
TV
book, Jessica B. Harris, High on the Hog, and it's the television show.
All right. And we will have a list of all the books that we talk about a little bit later today. We got to put it together at our website, capeandislands.org. Jill Erickson, Gail Blakely, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.